Welcome. This is Why Life Is. I'm Niles McFlower. Tonight, I thought we'd have a show dealing with the benefits of understanding ageless wisdom. This is kind of, it sounds like some kind of political announcement, doesn't it? But it isn't exactly. Although we are going to be starting a study group, I think it's going to be on September 2nd, Wednesday anyway, the first Wednesday in September. And it's going to be a teaching I'm going to teach, and it's going to be on Life and Meaning, which is a textbook I wrote. So, and you can participate in that. So I'm just letting you know up front you can do that. Now, the benefits of understanding ageless wisdom are kind of like part of itself. So if you can bear with me a bit, this show really is about what ageless wisdom is, because almost everything that is ageless wisdom is of benefit. It is the ontology and cosmology of our universe, in my opinion, of course, and it is the one that works when compared to, say, the standard model in physics, problems with quantum mechanics and relativity, theories of relativity, and also the issues of, we'll say, most of the complexities that are unintelligibly introduced or have been attempted to be used in physics in general and other sciences related to it. So it is the, we'll say, the solution for much of which is misunderstood and isn't working in today's real world. So that's what ageless wisdom just begins to do in terms of, we'll say, the whole universe. But in terms of benefits to those who gain understanding of it, it becomes a more, we'll call it, prosaic, and in some cases personal, but at least in most cases, because most people can't understand the benefits if it's only personal, which means subconscious, it becomes the solution for finding real meaning in life. And without the meaning in life, a person's life is of little consequence to them as well as to the way the universe functions. It's so strange to think about this, but let me put it in context. Someone who has a relatively unmeaningful life isn't just suffering as a result of it themselves. The whole universe suffers for each person or groups of people who find themselves with less meaning or no meaning or little meaning in their lives. And we're going to get to that whole process because this is part of the plan of our Creator in the reason for creation of life and for what ageless wisdom is. Ageless wisdom is the operational dynamics of the plan of God to create a meaningful experience for not only God, but for all that is God's creations, at least in the simplistic terminology of some of creations, because God ultimately is the ultimate creator. But we are co-creators, humans are, as well as other beings beyond human, and so to a much minor extent are some other lower forms of life. So it all comes together as a means of co-creation to begin with, and that's where we're going to start, by the way. And it ends in a process that the best way to determine it is that fulfills the meaning and need for meaning in existence. So anything that exists has a need for some relevant meaning. Now, the problem with it is that some of the meanings that happen to things that are much lower in consciousness or virtually lacking consciousness in comparison to a human being, the meaning for those things escapes us as being too far advanced. We would get so little out of it in comparison, we don't even grasp what that means. But it means something to something, to anything that has much, much less consciousness to even a sliver of the meaning that a human being needs might be sufficient. Because meaning is related to the ability to create. Okay. So let's talk about the very first benefit of understanding ageless wisdom. That benefit is to be able to become a better creator. Now let's talk also about what causes humans to cease or reduce their level of creation. If a human being is in a circumstance in which they are frightened to proceed with what we would call creation, they then have a propensity towards declining in the amount and in the ways that they may create. The greatest fear that humans have, in a relative term, is of death of consciousness. We aren't so... most people don't define it this way, but most people are not really afraid of the death of their physical body if their consciousness can go on and be part of some other interactive body, such as the next body being obviously, well, excluding the etheric, the next body in a more permanent fashion would be the astral. And so the fact that we have an astral body that is useful and maybe very different in its way of creation, but it gives us great opportunities nonetheless, and that we, our consciousness, which is key to this whole situation, continues. The consciousness continues. And we have an interactive body that reaches levels of human creation. We can create at a significant level, that means. And we can also co-create with others as well as our own creator. We can do all those things, then life has tremendous potential for meaning. The problem is when someone becomes afraid of death, the fear causes them to restrict in ways that are not necessarily about death, but they are in an odd way, to restrict the chances that they may take, to restrict the likelihood of failure they may have in creation. And all creation involves a fairly high potential for failure. And when we fail, it reminds us that we are mortal and that we are going to potentially lose something that keeps us, at least in our mind, alive in the physical world. So there's a lot of interconnectedness between the creation issue and fear of death. It is so great that if a person were to become, we'll say, highly neurotic, and there's a word that means that they exaggerate their feelings when people are neurotic. It's a simplistic psychological explanation. That means if they were highly neurotic, they would exaggerate the fear of death. And many people who are neurotic actually do such a thing. If they had that potential of failing in their psychology, the problem would be that the amount of meaning in their life would decline by a vast amount. So in other words, just one problem, fear of death, affects creation so violently as to reduce the meaning in life to levels that are subhuman if you were to average it out in comparison to what most people who don't have that kind of exaggerated fear would experience. And yet, a lot of people have a fear of death. So it's a whole package of problems for more than just the neurotic people, but neurotic people would be considered to be extremely disabled in their ability to be creative. All right, so let's look at this from the whole of the picture. This single factor, creation, is the beginning of most of the problems in people having meaningful lives. And that is the one of the biggest parts of what we're trying to do when we want people to, we'll say, get something from Angel's Wisdom as a benefit, is to alleviate that. And what then does that? And the answer is Angel's Wisdom, and this is the part that comes back on itself that I was explaining at the very beginning of the show, Angel's Wisdom helps people to understand that there is a God, and how that God can be communicated, reactive with, and how, what was the plan of that God. But also the most important thing is that the main part of the plan is creation itself. So when we look at it from that standpoint, wow. So Angel's Wisdom has its own answer, if you study it and understand it to some level, of the first major problem that people have in as human beings in living a life that's meaningful. This is not the only problem that we're going to explore tonight, but it's such a big one. And why not start with the biggest? I always say, yeah, that should, you know, why not? As long as you can understand it, start where it's most important to do so. So this is such a huge problem, and it's intertwined in so many different ways. Once you see how it works with governments and why people vote for certain things and why people tolerate certain things, it's going to be strange to hear about all this, but it's all part of what I call the first part of God's mind, the first ray of energy and its effect on existence, all kinds of things that all are interconnected to creation. All right, so, and the benefit of Angel's Wisdom to relieve the problem. So, again, the problem is best relieved by gaining an understanding of God, and how does that relieve the problem? Well, once we have an understanding of God and what God's plan is and how God enacts that plan. Now, let's talk about the enactment, or some people will call it the energy model or intelligent activity model, third part of God's mind. What is it that does the relief of this very bad symptom of life, in humans particularly, of being afraid of death? And the result is that you find that the process goes something like this. Humans are peculiar because they have a lot of awareness of God, because they have two senses to tell them God exists, which is a good thing. There's nothing wrong with that. But there is a weakness in that model, which God understands, in that humans are free to reject any sense or any knowledge that they have and replace it with even the most silly of ideas, if they choose to, if that's what they want. They have such incredible latitude to believe and to think they understand whatever they choose to. And the model is open, so it's like we can do as we choose to do. We're not forced by God to do much of anything. And so that's a really amazing part of God's plan, we'll call it. And so when humans choose to say, well, yeah, creation could lead to some failures, and failures could be very dangerous because they may reduce my ability to live this life, and I don't know for sure I'm going to live beyond this life. I mean, I listen to this guy on the radio, but who knows if he's right, you know, or something else. I've read a lot of books. I've gone to churches. I've gone to this place or that. So, you know, you have all that comforting, supposedly, but it doesn't prove anything, right? So the ultimate factor comes in, that what if? What if all that stuff is just nonsense, and once you're dead, you're gone, you're goodbye, And then, so I want to live as long as I possibly can, regardless of the quality of that life. Because after all, quality of life, even if it's great, if it's extremely short, it's great only for a very short time. And for a lot of people, that's an intolerable fear. Okay, and the meaning for life is truncated, even if you believe that there is great meaning in doing creative things. If you're going to truncate your life by a factor of 90% or something, because you're doing these creative things, could be very shortening of life in that realm, but you don't know if it's in that realm, maybe it's forever, then that causes a great deal of exaggerated fears and wrong decisions, in my opinion. All right, so here we have a system that has built into it this innate problem. And it comes from the need for God to give freedom for people to be creative, and therefore for people to be creative. The exercise of freedom is that they have doubts and they don't truly understand what to do. And then taking it further with this idea, people will put up obstacles to restrict their ability to be creative. Why? Because then they can blame those obstacles on their lack of creation and the meaning that they lose in life, which is an odd way, a comforting model to the way that some humans think. And it leads to bad governments, dictatorial, tyrannical governments that destroy creativity, and people tolerate it or even desire it because it comforts them in not thinking that they are the ones that are fearful to be creative. Well, I can't do it because the government says so. You know, it's not my fault. You know, if I can't be creative, they made all these rules up and I can't. I'm not allowed to do anything, you know, without getting permission, and permission can take for a lifetime. So maybe I won't be able to do much for my lifetime. It's not my fault, you know. Well, who creates government? The people in the United States, I believe that. But it depends what country you are in. But in the long run, if you really accept the idea that we are self-created beings, then government is just an extension of our own creations. And God doesn't create governments. People do. God creates or helps to create life, which is people. But the interesting thing here is that some people want these bad governments for very odd reasons, because they fear being creative. And then they want the government to be their parent and take care of them. Because after all, if the government's going to restrict them, they should get something back in return, and it should be some kind of handout or some kind of helpful thing for them, because if they're not going to have the benefit of understanding angels' wisdom, then they better get a benefit from the boogeyman that they create and endow with great authority and power to give them a reason why they are not being godly or creative themselves. It's a very self-protected system, and it works wonderfully for the dark side. The dark side loves this problem with human beings. Oh, they couldn't be happier than to have people running around afraid of governments and afraid of the creative side being diminished by restrictions of authority, restrictions of authority that has been invented and then fostered and et cetera by the people themselves. They love that. Does most of the work for them. It's a terrific system for them, because then they usurp that and they gain control over the people and they steal everything from them, eventually life itself. Their method of creation is to turn it into destruction of life, but in the process they gain the energy or power from that life. And so evil celebrates it. They think it's a wonderful idea that everybody run around afraid to be creative. And they do everything in their power, and I mean that literally, to make that happen. they will corrupt any government to make it so, even if the government originally isn't. All right, so we come to, and all the government is really the first part of God's mind. It's really an extension of some of the things that we're talking about. People create government supposedly to protect themselves from others who might take their creativity and their freedom. But in the long run, it's the governments that they create more often than not that does that. I know it's a very strange thing, but that's the truth. Now, true, if there was complete anarchy, it's possible that someone else's government, which is badly formed and doing negative things, would come in and take over people who are more anarchical. I don't suggest that. I suggest instead the government be what it was supposed to be. Protect us from the freedoms being taken away, but not take away our freedoms. So you can say, well, you got to give up freedom to have protection and security. No, you don't. That was invented by the dark side some eons ago, probably on another planet, even before Earth. But it's not true. It's not a true statement. I know that a lot of people believe that because they look at the contextual issues of how we presently use our technologies and our civilizations to supposedly protect people. But that's just carved out and done that way because nobody has looked at it from the other side and said, well, what are all the things government can do and help people to be more creative and help people to be more free while they're protecting them from others who are trying to prevent that from happening? If that were the way it was looked at, there are a myriad of solutions. A myriad. And you could create a government like that using constitutional form to provide that the government does things in what I'll call the correct way. But it has within it, the prevention of government to do several things. It can't grow on its own. It can't alter the rules and structure of people's lives on its own. And it requires a grooming, you might say, of most of the things that it does do based upon outside pressures to reduce freedom on a moment-to-moment basis almost. And it has to give up its power and authority in a lot of circumstances where threats no longer exist. This becomes a dynamic government, one that shrinks twice, three, five times as fast as it expands, and has a limitation on almost every quality that can come from the restriction of freedom and creativity. This is interesting, interesting proposal that I'm making here, because we start seeing the benefits of ageless wisdom and understanding ageless wisdom has to do with how you begin formulating a government, how you choose to live your life in terms of purpose and creativity and freedom, and it goes on from there. Beaky stuff. And if you think about it, I hope you are, nothing I'm saying is really all that impossible to do. The real impossible part is getting people to change. And that comes from studying and understanding ageless wisdom. It doesn't come to people otherwise, because there's nothing else I know of that will gain the needed understanding to overcome the basic fears that I talked about earlier. Fear of death and some other, we'll call them side-related issues to that. All right, so, fascinating idea if you think about it. A lot of the problems of human beings, the reason they keep emerging from one country to the next, and even from one generation or one century or one millennia to the next, is because humans are afraid. And because they do this to themselves in order to have a rationale for their own level of cowardice and fear of death. this is a strange theory, I know. And some people will disagree with me and say, well, how can you make such terrible widespread ideal thoughts about humans, etc.? And I say, well, it is what it is. You got to call it what it is. I don't know how else to explain all the elements in our historical context of how humans have created their lives. And I'm just starting with government right now. We're going to get to other areas of creation. But you can see that this is a biggie. Now let's talk about the second ray as it applies to this particular idea, because it has, there's some issue here. People, when they're creative, have to have a great deal of consciousness in their creations, or the creations generally fail. Now, why is that? Why can't someone just say, well, I'm a big gambler, I'll try this or I'll try that, and we'll see how it goes. Like trial and error and everything. What the heck? It's only one life that's little bitty. Maybe they truly believe that. Why would that be a problem then? Well, there's a recklessness and a kind of disregard for the sake of all. The second way says that we're all connected, but our connectivity still remains secondary to our individuality, and that we can share our connectivity with each other. And part of the reason there is reality at all, there is existence, is because we have a basic understanding of the connectivities of others, or there would be no reality. What we call particles and fields and all the other stuff that there in physics really is a bunch of nonsense. Those are the results of people's, we'll call it, connections or understanding, which comes from their thought. Thought is the ability to create with understanding. It goes away when it's not there. Now, the thought and understanding for things less than human beings comes from souls, the group souls of those things that we're talking about, whatever they might be. But for humans, it comes directly from the human. It is connected to an individual soul, but the human is in the driver's seat. And if humans create without understanding, then the process is no longer relational to others, so there's a disregard for the results of the creation. Excessive amounts of resources are wasted and used up, and pain and suffering is the result not only to the person doing it because of their laissez-faire, trial and error, whatever they're doing, method, but they do commensurate harm to quite a few other people, if not everybody, in some respect. So this is the problem with that particular kind of thinking. And education is required to change it, because humans by nature are driven first by personal or selfish interest rather than interest for the better good, the greater good. That they have to learn, and they learn it through the development of a conscience and consciousness, along with the education of the self about the relationships that everybody else has about many other things, or a lot of people have about a lot of things, which develops empathy and a greater good understanding, and mostly understanding God. Again, Angel's Wisdom, there it is, popping in. And so through all those channels, if education is correct and done in a way that does those things I just said, you end up with the benefit of increased understanding about many things, not just Angel's Wisdom, but it starts with Angel's Wisdom because it starts with God. Now, when you take God out of the education of people, that's in a severe weakness. Now, I know education, public education, comes from the government, and the government can't have a position on a certain religion. But I'm not talking about religion. I'm talking about whether there's God or not. And this is my approach, that most people, probably 85-90% of people, have enough sense in their heart and crown chakras to be informed that there is a God to some level. So their belief is there's a God, and beyond that, their understanding is to some level of whatever the level of consciousness is. Therefore, with the majority, vast majority having that, the correct approach is that it's okay to teach about God in school, including the other side, that maybe God doesn't exist for those who seek to believe that, but there's more to it, that their God does exist, but we'll teach everything, without teaching one specific religion as being the way to discover or understand God. And so this becomes part of the educational system, and it isn't against the idea that we shouldn't have religion pushed on people, rather they should have the options to determine for themselves, but it should still be taught. Now, that's my suggestion. The reason for that is that most of the other problems of education stem from that one. When you disallow it, and we'll talk about this when we get to the sixth ray, two elements of the same thing about freedom. When you disallow it, the freedom that people can enjoy is actually stifled by a significant amount. So people who go to public schools who espouse nothing about God, one way or the other, can be taught in the school. Well, that's the same as making a choice literally to be anti-God in some respects. If you think about it, it's not a neutral place. It's not neutral. Because you can't talk about it at all. Well, why not? Freedom is the ability to talk about anything, right? Freedom is the ability to learn about things that other people don't like, but that maybe it's okay that those things for some people. And so you are restricting freedom again. And you can see why I'm bringing this so strongly into the idea of education. What else also restricts freedom in education? Well, anytime the concepts presented about anything, I don't care if it's evolution, but it all relates back to God, you'll see this, or any other aspect that is touted as being the only way to think about something, the only concepts that are allowed are those. That is a severe restriction in freedom, and it causes a de-evolvement of education itself and a reduction in understanding both ageless wisdom and in gaining consciousness. It reduces consciousness for those going to schools like that. And that's the majority of the schools here in the United States and many other countries. Whoa. Now we see some problems. The benefits of understanding ageless wisdom is that we have to be free to be able to think, free to be able to learn about whatever we want to learn about and think about. And there not be restrictions on it, because if you make restrictions, hey, you're just destroying this first part of God's mind. It's a huge problem. And it's anti-ageless wisdom, of course. And so the benefits of understanding ageless wisdom reverses this. People don't go to schools like that that want to benefit from understanding ageless wisdom, because there won't be any ageless wisdom taught in those schools. They won't even know what it is, actually. And so if you really want to solve part of this problem, you need, unfortunately, to probably move or change your school, or maybe pay something more, or whatever it's going to require, maybe make some political decisions too. All those things are required if you're going to have a change systematically in people. When education is run into this lack of freedom, along with the fear of creativity, and then the giving up of one's personal life, so to speak, to a governmental regime, you end up a lot with what is the code of, we'll call, conduct and the means of acting for people who are highly into a more socialistic or communistic thought process, and who oftentimes here in the United States are of the extreme democratic or left-wing persuasion. In those circumstances, those people will not gain the benefits of ageless wisdom, because they have short-circuited them by strong contradictory beliefs and otherwise. And the results can be pretty disastrous. Because, again, the meaning in life is so stilted, so reduced, that those people could end up in situations where most of their life seems meaningless. They become easy victims for the very government that they helped to create, to give them an excuse for why they can't create. Okay. So I hope this is not confusing, because there's a lot here that I'm trying to explain tonight, and some of it you got to think really deep into, because it's not as self-evident until you look at the more microscopic viewpoints of how it all fits together. Okay. And then what about people who, from the standpoint of how the third ray affects the freedom of folks, how does it affect them? Us in terms of living in our culture, in our civilization? Where does this really fit? Well, when people are afraid to be creative, the culture of the civilization and the technology as well that comes from all that becomes redundant and, we'll say, it slows in growth, for sure, and it becomes usually affixed to the needs of the corrupt. The corrupt may be in government, big business, wherever. So all of the benefits of being creative in terms of creating things that expand the benefits of society, of civilization, become stolen in a way. By those with power and through corruption, they benefit from it to some extent, and the rest of the people lose meaning in their lives. Now, you could also claim, well, just because they benefit from it materially, are they really getting meaning in their lives? And the answer is sometimes, because they use the material wealth that they gain to buy their freedom around all the restrictions that they also support for the masses. So, yes, they do actually get more freedom, but at a high cost, but the cost is well worth it to them, because they have so much, they can use it, spread it around to, in many illicit ways and in some semi-legal ways, can make it so that their life is, believe it or not, amazingly meaningful, at least at the level they're willing to do that. And they might be fairly creative. They might. But not, it's, again, for much more selfish reasons. And there is very little benefit that may be derived by anybody other than themselves. It could also benefit their group. Their group may be a bunch of other people, like industrialists or whatever, to get something out of it. Or more often these days, people in the governmental regime that they are working with. But regardless, it is corrupt. That doesn't mean that all people who are in this vein, who have wealth and they're part of an industrial complex, in some way are corrupt. No, it's just the opposite, actually. People who are creative in those ways build great resources for everybody else to co-create with them if they are truly, we'll call it, conscious. Well, we're running out of time for this segment, and we're going to come back. But I want you to think about a tremendous amount of concepts here, a lot of ideas, how angels, benefits of understanding angels' wisdom can be seen. And I've only scratched the surface, and tonight's show is going to be about a little over half an hour longer than most of the rest of the shows, because we actually have someone joining the station who is going to come after the show in those 35 minutes that I've been enjoying for a number of months now will not be available, because there'll be somebody else in that spot. But we'll still have the 2 hours almost that I have had, and that's, I think, good enough for right now. So, we will be back in about 2.5 minutes from right now.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. McFlower.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
We're back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm Niles McFlower. Tonight, we're dealing with the subject, the benefits of understanding ageless wisdom. And hopefully you have heard the first part of the show, and I think that it's maybe coming through why this is the case, that there are some really big benefits if we can all understand more about ageless wisdom. Okay, so let's continue on. We've dealt with the first relevant three parts, we call it, of God's mind, but there's much more to this. The third part has many other factors to it, we'll call it that. And when we examine what most people consider a big part of life, which is being creative in an artful sense, being creative of things that produce more beauty, more balance, a balance between the form and spirit and all that is around us. Those kinds of really important elements to making life meaningful become lost as the world around us becomes darker because the senses of everyone are damaged. And as those senses are damaged, there's an inability to find through our senses our own creator, because beauty is very, very, we'll say, key to being the balance in helping us to maintain a meaningful life. Now, some people might say, well, I don't have much need for all of that. As long as things work okay, why should I concern myself with the element of beauty and balance? And whether something is spiritual or not, doesn't matter to me. I just want something that works. Well, that may be true for a few people. But most people actually, they may say that because they are lacking some understanding. But in the long run, as people grow and develop their lives, it makes a larger and larger difference whether or not there is this element, we'll call it the element of artful beauty or of beyond art, the balance of God and spirits, which is the thought of God, in the form of anything. And things that contain form but are not spiritually balanced produce some very hideous results. And for some people, they begin to realize that the meaning in life is lost because so many other people lose their grasp on God as they lose their sense of beauty, and they make things ugly. And as more and more ugliness around us happens, that causes the destruction of what we talked about before the break, which was of civilization, and the eventual criminality of intent from many people, and the loss of meaning in life. All you have to do is look at what's happening, like if you live in the United States or you've seen news about it, in Detroit, Michigan. Here's a big city that has become mostly lost of beauty. A lot of people say, well, Detroit never really was the most beautiful city. Well, that could kind of be true in relative terms, but today it's pretty ugly. And the ugliness comes from neglect and from people no longer creating beauty. Beauty on its own does not survive. It has to have constant creation, or recreation at least, to even sustain any elements of it. After years of time of disuse and of abuse, beauty virtually vanishes, and the system pays dearly for it. Now, a lot of people are going to say, well, it all happened because the tax base left. Well, why did the tax base leave? People left because there was a lot of ugliness around them. The ugliness might be crime and drugs in some respect, but it's also the most important part of it, the lack of creation of form that has beauty to it. People just let everything fall apart and didn't create anything new that had beauty and form. And that was the ticket for poisoning that city. It took decades, but recovering it now would require a huge number of people going in and creating beauty, at least on a small level, or a few people doing it on a very large level. And I don't think either one is going to happen in the near future because the creation model has been aborted and has been somewhat destroyed by the principles of the dark side moving creation away from form itself and into government power and control. Even the unions, which are being blamed to some extent for this, have become an extension of the governmental control issue. And so it's a kind of a weird model because they're receiving the brunt of the problem. They also are the creators of the problem. And they are a pseudo extension, false extension of the government. They aren't really the government, but for all intents and purposes, they control so much of what government did in this area of the country that they created the seeds for the destruction in economic terms. Now, those seeds include corruption, in effect. Getting something for nothing is always corrupt, and government that provides a vehicle for doing this to buy votes and to stay in power is corrupt. And that's what happened in that town. Now, if you look at all the problems here, you can see that beauty is the answer to so many things, but it is, in some places, it's vanishing or gone. And that is terribly, terribly sad. It means that the meaning of life is being short-circuited by one of the seven parts of God. And this is the fourth part. And it makes it almost intolerable for people who are spiritual deliverer. So they, we'll call it, by their need to have a more meaningful life, they, by nature, leave. Some of them, a few, my brave ones, may have stayed on trying to do something, but I think at this point, most of them have left. This is not the only city this is happening. It's the one we know about today. It's likely in a few more years there'll be dozens more. And you should be aware that this is not an issue that can be solved by just economics. I know a lot of people think that that's the case. Well, if the government just gave money, or if, I guess if they could print more themselves, which they're not allowed to do. But I mean, if there was some, you know, simple answer like that, a lot of people would say, well, let's just do that. But it's, that would never work. What will work is restoring freedom back to people so they can create more of God in all the ways that we've been talking about so far. And there's much more, but I just trying to let you see that the big picture here, it comes from angel's wisdom, not from some, you know, fairy tale where someone just wills a bunch of money to everybody and suddenly they're going to solve a problem. Just the opposite. If you gave everybody in Detroit, let's say I bequeathed them $250,000. I mean, not a small amount of money, but it's probably not the biggest as it used to be. But it gave everybody $250,000 and said, here, make Detroit a better place. It would probably go just the opposite, because they would be less creative, because so much was being given to them for nothing, getting something for nothing. Remember that creed I said so often. And the dark side would have a great time with that. They would actually love that. And then in short order, there would be so much corruption that most of the people would lose the money, and it would go to the people who are the most evil and corrupt. And then even the people who were able to still hold on to the money wouldn't use it in any way that would be meaningful, because they'd be too afraid to. And that would still lead to a virtual shallow nothing life for them. And certainly wouldn't benefit any system of repair or improvement to the overall city and the life of everybody in it. So you see that money alone is not going to be the answer, and may not be the answer virtually at all. The answer here is what's, it's, the problem is in the people themselves. You have like 60, 70% of the people on welfare of some point. That's just a very big number. You have 15% recorded in to be out of work, which means it's about really 30% of the people are not actually meaningfully employed. And so that's a huge problem in itself, not just to, because, I mean, you could give them the money, as I said, but working involves something different than just earning money. It gives people some ability to say that they are contributing to their life in some way through their own endeavors. I know that sounds hard for most people to believe, because, well, I just stand in line and punch numbers, or I make a car or something. I mean, it's way more than that. People have to become more relatively disciplined. They got to show up for work. They got to learn a job. They got to work with others. All of those things are basic factors that change the way people structure and live their life. And if you remove that, if you're not working and you don't have that, you start to decline rapidly from what would be considered maybe a tolerable position in life of some meaning to a terrible life of meaninglessness, which often leads to violence and crime, and just a debilitated state for each person in that position. And we're saying, I'm saying, there's 30% or more of the population in that position. And a population is half of what it used to be. So the people who wouldn't tolerate such a restriction in their creativity left. By natural selection, therefore, we have the people who are most likely looking for the government to be their parent and take care of them, and the rest of the people who would never find that meaningful have left. It's a big problem. It's a serious, serious big problem. It's not just Detroit. Remember what I said, it's going to be dozens of other cities, but it's going to be something more than that if we don't do something very soon to change our whole leadership issue. Okay, so getting back to what I was talking about, the benefits of Angel's Wisdom in terms of beauty is that it is self-supportive in consciousness by developing improved senses in all the people who experience anything of beauty. And when a person makes something more beautiful themselves, they get double the effect. they not only get the benefit of something more beautiful being around them, the creation of beauty, you get the benefit of everybody that you also help their senses with. You benefit from all of that. So people who are into creating beauty rise quickly in the meaning of their life, and they benefit tremendously if they understand what they're doing from ageless wisdom. All right, so let's talk about almost the flip side of that. What about people who are trying to discover more analytical and conceptual ways of serving within the society they live, the civilization they live in, the country they live in too? What about those folks? Well, they're doing something else. They're trying to help the monastic or mental thinking of people. And that's what we call science, and also the basic research element in science of discovering new understandings of how the physical universe and the electromagnetic part of it relates. Some scientists are even into ageless wisdom enough so they're concerned about things that are beyond the present known science, like metaphysics is. The biggest part of this is that if you're into trying to conceptually understand why something is happening a certain way, and you're doing it from the monastic or mental way of thinking, which is what humans tend to try to do, then your life becomes more meaningful because you have concepts that tell you why a lot of the examples in life are that way. It doesn't change the world as much to do that, but it certainly has a chance to do some good. And for a lot of people, it's not a bad deal. So people who are into this kind of thinking, some of whom are engineers, some are scientists of various nature, some are into the mathematical realm, some are into some elements of legal things and laws. Others have maybe a propensity towards studying the mind for the mind's sake, and also understanding what understanding is or consciousness is from a conceptual framework. So it has a broad field to it, and it gets into a lot of different elements. If you use ageless wisdom in that process, as you formulate these concepts, the concepts lead to very big concepts that explain how God interacts with people and how people can interact with each other in more, we'll call it, causal ways. In other words, if you do this, it's likely you're going to get that kind of result, and you find all kinds of operative causal ways to help others and yourself to gain meaning in their lives. And this is a big deal. It may also involve the medical and allopathic medicine ways of helping people to improve their life through reducing the amount of pain and suffering that people go through, and maybe even extending the physical lifetime, which may not be all that big of a deal, but it definitely has some importance. It's more important when a person is living a meaningful life, because then they can go on to do even more meaningful things. If a person is wasting their life, it's probably less important. So when we examine all of this, it's an interesting potential here. We get a kind of picture now of how freedom, and the freedom to involve ourselves in creating even concepts of how people can gain an understanding of why the interactions that they have and the relationships they have are with everything from physical things to people to everything else, is of value and helpful. And it's all based, again, on ageless wisdom, which is so strange, because most people say, well, it's just general knowledge, isn't it? No, it's not general knowledge, because knowledge doesn't really help us that much. Concepts are not just knowledge. Concepts are formulas that prove over and over again the truth or validity of some knowledge. So that's a totally different thing. And it can involve wars. It can involve a lot of other stuff, too. So it's a very interesting perspective when we look at it from that standpoint. And now I'm going to move on to the idea of faith and religion. Now, a lot of people, when they examine their need to be free and to be creative, they don't consider things like, how am I going to communicate and worship, to some extent, God? How am I going to have a meaningful relationship with God? And for some people, they require religion. Others require some structure, even if it isn't a specific religion. And this is all considered to be like the sixth ray of expression, and it's all subcategorized under the third. So basically, what we're really talking about is, how do people interact intelligently with each other and everything else around them in form, so that their faith in God increases and their ability to communicate with and from God improves. Now, communication from God can be in some ways direct. You can meditate, you can pray, you can do a lot of things. Or it can be based upon a specific religious viewpoint that tells you what God is based upon parameters decided by others. That may or may not be fully correct, but it doesn't require as much, we'll call it analytical thinking, and doesn't require someone to test all the elements of their faith to see which ones are the most relevant to them. They go into a religion, and it's all laid out before them. The problem with a religion is it's a mixed bag. Some of it does exactly what I just said, and it does it well. It gives people a good understanding of the way that you need to communicate with God, and God will communicate with you. You do these things, and everything will be hunky-dory. That part sometimes works okay for some people some of the time. The problem with almost all religions is that they have parts of them that don't work for a lot of people, some or a lot of the time. And that's because the person's own creativity is so far removed from the practice of the religion and the faith issues in the religion that there's very little growth in the religion, there's very little change in it, and worse, people in it lose creativity rather than gain creativity, because religion has so many restrictions and rules, it becomes a quasi-government. The things that are wrong with government, that could be wrong with government, can become wrong with any kind of religion. And so people, again, are stuck with the issue of losing their freedom, and many people are willing to give up that freedom because they are blessed by God through usually some, we'll call it emissary of God. That can be anywhere from a priest to a nun to maybe this person who says they know it all about the God that they're talking about. You see, these issues all stem from the same thing, don't they? The fear of death, going back, remember, all that's, everything's underlying the original fear, right? And some solution to it that that evokes a sense of, well, someone's taking care of me and it'll all be okay as long as I just go to church and say these things and do these things and whatever. That's the misnomer. Because down the line, that sort of, we'll call it shenanigans with our feelings, eventually ends up backfiring, and people end up in a quagmire of doubt and a frustration, which is sort of an anger, but it's sort of hidden, that what they were believing in can't all be true. But the problem is, one of the things that most religions do, which is terrible, is you buy it all, or you're not really a believer. You're not really a follower. You're not included in their thinking. So you got to kind of like take the whole thing And, of course, that is what's wrong with the sixth ray. It is very singular. It has this one kind of way of looking at things. And so religions tend to have that as a common factor. And they don't share all of the different things with each other. So if you're one religion, you're going to naturally tend to reject all the other ones, which is what people who are the proponents of the religion want to have happen. They want the exclusive right of those that are following the religion to not entertain any of the benefits or beliefs of any other religion. Wow, most of them like that. If you're Baha'i, that's a particular faith that believes in a combination of like 11 religions or whatever. If you're into that, at least you have a more open mind about it. But the problem is it still has the same thing. It just has made it a little looser and easier for some people to buy it. Ageless Wisdom doesn't have that problem. Now, Ageless Wisdom is not a religion. It doesn't tell you specifically what or how to communicate with God and the things you need to do to be in God's grace or any of that stuff. It tells you the opposite, that what you need to do is to be creative and create more of what is called virtue, which is spiritual thought within the forms of those things that you interact with, and help others to experience God in any way they choose. But just to help them do it by their own standards and the ways they want it. Well, that's way different than religions in general. But that's Ageless Wisdom. And the benefits of that way of functioning is that you can take that and apply it to any religion, and you can buy the parts of the religion that were originally created from Ageless Wisdom and that have done a lot of good, and you can reject those parts that aren't without claiming that you violated some trust with that religion. But you have to do so with great braveness and to possibly being ostracized, excommunicated by some. I mean, the possibility is there once you start going down that path that others may not be so, we'll say, forgiving of that particular position. The reason for it is it threatens the power and control of those in charge, those in control of the religion we're talking about. So that's where it gets very dangerous. Some religions are proponents of killing others who, in general, don't obey or believe in certain parts of themselves. And this in itself is bizarre, isn't it? And then people become more afraid of those religions from doing anything because they realize that religion gives the right for others within a religion to become murderers. Well, that's always a pretty bad problem. And if you experience that, the best thing is to find a different sect or a different religion. And certainly do so by examining Ageless Wisdom so you can recognize a lot of these issues that I'm talking about, truth in the fifth way of seeing things, or possibly freedom in education, or just freedom itself. Anyone that challenges the right of those who it interacts with to be free in thinking and in action in general, those people are on the dark side of things. Remember that, because it's an important idea. And that's one of the benefits of understanding Ageless Wisdom when we look at it from the sixth ray perspective. Now, what about the idea of creating interactions that are prosperous, to produce the ability to increase the concentration of time and energy, which is, by most people's standards, what we call money, and that does so through the exchange of goods and services, as well as the, we'll call it the increase of people's ability to do the same, not just one-sided. In Ageless Wisdom, the idea of creating wealth is that wealth is only created when it allows others to do the same. Wealth that is created at the cost of freedom of others to do the same. We could talk about that in terms of monopoly or communism. capitalism or communism when it goes awry, although communism has a really good resolution to the other side, whereas capitalism, you just say, well, you have to have free markets, but you also have to prevent people from becoming monopolistic and controlling all of the market to only their own benefit. That's a bad thing. So you look at it from that standpoint, and you say, wow, this is a system of organization and synthesis that leads to the benefit of wealth and the benefit of prosperity, and allows people to create material, physical things that are needed by the others that are willing to invest their time and money into creating more of that, or they create less tangible things, but the creation of those less tangible things are still going to do pretty much the same thing. As far as Ageless Wisdom is concerned, this sort of synthesizing of our surroundings in a material, maybe an electromagnetic sense as well, is the critical element to the physical world. It's why anywhere you go in the physical world, there's a necessity for some economic exchange. And without it, people suffer immensely in their freedom because they decline in their wealth to the point where they can't even support themselves. They can't manage to do virtually anything. And it's the reason you've got to have free markets instead of socialism or communism. It's the reason that the only thing that works is when people participate freely in the system and can synthesize themselves into it or away from it, rather than to be force-fed and in some way debilitated through handouts and welfare. The process is critical because in the physical world, the forces are so great to inhibit growth that if you don't use the principles of wealth creation through synthesis, the forces are great enough in the physical world now to prevent almost all growth. So we could say that in almost every sense of creating wealth in the physical world, the interests of others are borrowed of sorts. The ability to make something new comes from those in contributions by thousands of others who have done something not quite the same, but you can rely upon them to understand the concepts they used and build upon them. That's the way that the physical world gets around the force problem. It's through the motives and energies of so many others. You don't have to do that in the astral world, but you have to do it here in order to accomplish much of anything because the forces are so great it will prevent you otherwise. And most people do not appreciate what a free market system is and what creating wealth is in terms of creating a meaningful life and more of God. And this is misunderstood unless you're into Ageless Wisdom, because the factors that make people wealthy are so well hidden by facades that have been created in our society. Why? Well, because the wealthy want to look magnanimous and as benefactors for those who aren't. Why do they choose to do that? Well, because they want the admiration and love of these others, and or they want to hide their own avarice and their lack of caring for others. So it's a problem. If you really care about others, it's not a problem, because then you recognize that the wealth you create for yourself has to benefit others as well, and so then you don't create a system that is purely selfish. But this is such a difficult concept that so few people really understand it. They believe that being purely selfish is the correct way to be if you live in a free market system. And of course it isn't. But at the same time, a controlled system, such as socialism, does the reverse. It destroys the individual and the individual rights for creation over time. even if you modify it and try to prevent it from happening, there's no, once you go down the road, you end up with it happening no matter what. And so for most people, the creation of freedom requires the creation of wealth. And for also sharing the levels of creation that are used with others so that they can do their own creation, but use what you have. Just the way you did when you created your wealth, you synthesized it from using the seventh way approach from so many others. Otherwise, in most cases, it'd be almost impossible for the average person, or even above average person, to overcome the forces to be creative in this physical world and make wealth. It's just nearly impossible. We all are borrowing so much from so many others in the process. Even if we make great inventions that supposedly have patents and things, much is borrowed about so many different elements of everything that's created in the wealth region. And that's included within free markets. All right. That being the case, I think we've covered the benefits of freedom and creativity and purpose in life, which leads to directly whether or not a life will be meaningful or not. And this is one of the beginning benefits, believe it or not, we're still on the first part of Ageless Understanding, Ageless Wisdom. And I hope this is, these are all thumbnails. Do not believe that what I've said for the last hour and 15 minutes or so is in any way inclusive of everything. It's quite the opposite. It's little pieces so that you can say, I think I got it. And if you studied Ageless Wisdom, much, much, much more would be understood about the benefits. But for the intent of tonight's show, I'm just trying to touch on these things so that people can say, well, it really is worth doing this, or, well, it don't matter to me because I don't see anything coming out of it. Yeah. All right, let's move on now to the bigger scope of our, the next big scope of our looking at this situation, and that is consciousness and love as being a part of the meaning in life. And creation is number one. It's really the first part of what makes light light. It's the enlightenment of the physical world, too. But when we deal with the consciousness issue, and we'll call it universal love, love becomes a whole other parameter in which life becomes meaningful for people. Without it, you can be very, very creative on the first side and have a purpose, but the meaning in life becomes significantly reduced if the life that you're living is without this universal love aspect to it. Now, let me tell you the problems and where they come from. The first is the government. We'll talk about government and start all over again, but we're going to look at it from a totally different angle now. All right. When you build a government that is supposedly running around telling people that they need to care about and love people who are disadvantaged, without money, without this or that, without education, without whatever, and that they need to do this by being taxed, by being restricted, by forcing them to change their allegiances, even to their family and friends, for various political power reasons, that when that happens, people lose meaning in their life because real love doesn't involve any of that. As a matter of fact, that's the antithesis, meaning the opposite idea of what love is. If someone tells people, well, you're going to all go out and you got to be good humanitarians, you should be giving to charities, and then more than that, you need to take a third of your income, half of your income, and give it to us, the government, so that we can redistribute your wealth to those who are disadvantaged. That's love. Well, that's the opposite of love. Let me explain why it is. You see, when you recognize love, love is to help people to become more creative and individual themselves. Love, that's what love does. Hate, control, manipulation, overpowering causes people to not be more individual and causes them to be dependent and slaves. Okay? So if you give your wealth to a government that then indiscriminately gives it, and we'll get to the discrimination issue more, but for general purposes, I'll just use the word here, indiscriminately gives it to people based upon some crazy criteria. Well, how much did you work in the last year? Okay, if I don't work, I get benefits. That sounds good. and then they increase the wealth, they redistribute the wealth of those that are individuals and creating to those who have some problem with doing that. You're making those people into slaves. At first, they're weakened in their ability to be individuals, and then they weaken their ability to create. We talked about that when we were in the last hour. And then you also make them something else. You make them selfish. They look at their life as by how much others will give them something for something they didn't earn or create for themselves, something for nothing. And this causes them to be prime candidates to be slaves to the government and or to the company or whatever who's doing this to them that is redistributing wealth. Whoa. So if you've got universal love says you don't participate in that system. You resist it. You fight against it. Better to not earn the money to give to a government that will do that than to give it to a government that makes slaves out of others. Because then you're participating in the evil. You can see the problem that this entails. What happens if the government just comes and takes it from you? Well, eventually it does do that. And then you have to do everything you can to change that government or leave. But you need to do something because otherwise you're participating in an evil system. The evil is anti-universal love. It isn't loving to give people something that enslaves them and weakens their ability to be individuals. That's a huge, huge penalty. And you're basically doing it through manipulation and control of the rich and disenchantment, disenfranchisement in some cases, from the poor. And in between, there's a whole bunch of people being further moved like cattle to just give up their creative abilities and rights to become saddled with this onerous taxing system and a gigantic, powerful government that is working against the good. All right, so the overall problem that we can say is that redistribution is a form of evil. It is used by those who are evil, and those who have the most power that use it are the most evil. I want you to think about that. Who do you know who does that sort of thing? Now, getting to the benefit issue, the benefit of Ageless Wisdom is it wakes people up to this. Those people who really have an understanding of Ageless Wisdom get it. Those who don't think that Ageless Wisdom is some kind of fake love. The fake love is, well, just give to people because, after all, giving is good, right? Even if it's unwise, even if it hurts people in so many different ways, giving is a good thing, and then we can all smile at each other and say, that's what Ageless Wisdom is. It's that us liking each other for that which we give up, supposedly, so that others can have more wealth at the detriment of themselves and the increased power of those in the government and other powerful positions. This is a very, very sly and terrible system. Okay, let's go also into the idea of education now and talk about that in terms of this process of trying to see the benefit of Ageless Wisdom. Well, when consciousness and love is diminished because we educate people to all think the same way and that they all will do the bidding of those who are the educators in the same way and who, worse than that, are taught things that are usually either incomplete concepts or just plain wrong concepts, but for the benefit and edification of those who are teaching, oftentimes egotistically and many times, or sometimes arrogantly. This kind of system has a huge problem in it because it deals with young people who are formidably going to be changed and who have little defenses to an onslaught from adults, usually, who are seen in authority and high positions who are teaching them. Now, they may be even college students, which we call them young, almost young adults, but it still doesn't matter because those people are, it's the same system if you're in first grade or third year grade or if you're a freshman in college or maybe even a senior in college. All the way through the system, it's designed basically to lack consciousness and reduce love, universal love, and get people to follow the ideas and thought of those who claim they better understand. See? It doesn't get people to challenge the better understanding. It doesn't get people to think more. It does the reverse. Don't think as much. Don't challenge what I'm saying, because I'm your teacher, I'm your professor, I'm whoever you are, you know, in relationship. But you need to do this because I know more. And pretend like I'm more conscious than you are, too. Of course, they're less conscious, but that's not the point. As long as other people buy into it, I don't care if they're a first grader or a senior in college or maybe a graduate student. If they buy into it, then their fate is sealed. And how is it sealed? Well, the educational system leads to a singular set of beliefs and singular set of, we'll call it, knowledge-based answers for what life is and how it should be lived. Of course, that leads to people who are both unloving and who are egotistical, usually. And so you get a terrible combination here. It's really a bad combination. Of course, it also reduces freedom. That's, every time you cut down consciousness, it will reduce freedom as well in people. And so here, the consciousness of people, if it's disturbed by a bad education system, because it's so pervasive, I mean, we spend huge amounts of time educating ourselves as human beings, and it can start at 3 years old, and formal education can. In some cases, it's even 2.5 in some places. But as it moves up, we become almost mesmerized by the system that we choose to be in or that others choose for us to be in. And there's little room for real thinking and little room for thinking in any way that's different from those who are teaching or are in some way part of the teaching system. This is really bad, you can see. And people who get into those kinds of public, usually, systems, but some of them are private, desire control in a mental sense over others. They seek that first instead of seeking to educate others by thinking more for themselves. So the selfishness and the anti-love in the educational system is coming from the desire to have others think that the people doing the education are the ones who know the most, who think the best, and who should be listened to, and that all others who don't are really ignorant fools who should be ostracized and punished and in every way diminished. Terrible. All of this is anti-love, of course. It's all against love. The people that come out of such a system usually have a very hard time loving anybody. And it's hard to imagine this because so many people say, well, I went to a traditional school and I turned out okay. Yeah, okay, who do you love? Well, I love my children, I love my husband, I love my wife. Yeah, okay, what is it that shows that you do that? Well, I sent my children to the same kind of school. And when they come home, I tell them just to read what they learned and be able to regurgitate it with getting an A on the test that they're going to be given about it. No, I don't want them thinking on their own about something different because what they teach there is the right thing because that's what I know. Is that love? All right, so then, yeah, and then, of course, why are family issues, which we're going to get into now in this situation, why are family issues compounded and made worse by the love problem in, we'll call it, the consciousness side of not benefiting from ageless wisdom? Well, when you are brought up in an educated way that suggests that it's okay to control others by your own thinking, when you get into a relationship with somebody that you have feelings for, genuine feelings maybe, of love, those general feelings become contradicted or in conflict with the egotism that you and your partner may have. Both people usually are egotistical. And that's what leads to the breakup of the relationship more times than not. And in other words, these days, it isn't whether people love each other in some feeling context. It's that they don't show any love for the other person's point of view. And they disrespect the other person's thinking differently. You could say, well, then why not just have everybody team up with people who think very much the way they think, and then there should be no problem with families or marriage. Well, there is some truth to that in some respects. The only problem is that both of them are still unloving. The only reason they are able to stay together is because they're unloving, and in their delusional issues about being unloving, they think pretty much the same selfish ways, so they can tolerate each other for maybe years or decades, and they can raise a family, and their children can become just like them. And in the long run, you end up with people who have a lack of meaning in their lives, which eventually tears them apart, although they might be much older than not, and also causes their families not to do very well. It's unloving to not seek a feeling and thinking in those around us. And it's unloving to deny people the right to be conscious in ways different from ourselves, which may be an improvement over what we are. Even if it's not, they have a right to have a difference. And that kind of unlovingness is very, very severe. It leads to all kinds of destructive elements that we build into our families and into the raising of our children and what we call a loving relationship with another person. So it becomes a really interesting problem, doesn't it? That ageless wisdom can solve this as a benefit by getting people to recognize that the first love they have comes from the love of God to them to be free, to think for themselves, and to help others to do the same, and to not give anything to anyone that enslaves them, restricts them from being able to think for themselves, or reduces their ability to earn their own wealth or their own interactions with others or to do anything. Because to do so causes us to become the antithesis of God. And there's no such thing as loving someone by being the antithesis of God. You only use them and control them and abuse them. Now, it's tough for people to see this, especially if they're entwined in this ridiculous kind of relationship or relationships, because you can have this more than just in a family situation. It could be in a work situation. It could be many different ways, or an extended family situation. And so many families have these basic problems in them. And until people see the benefit of understanding ageless wisdom to solve those problems, they look too narrowly to strange places to find solutions for such, we'll say, big problems. They may go to a book, a self-help book on, you know, understanding how to talk to your spouse in a way that allows them some comfort and know that you care about them. Yeah, you say the right words, but in reality, it's either you think my way or it's no good. And so we all have to kind of come to some compromise almost about how we're going to be non-creative together and to be egotistical together. I see this so often in relationships with people and in families in general. The children are almost in the same vein. The children sometimes fight against them. You get a rebellious thing going on, too. That's a whole other factor. But still, the ageless wisdom answer is help people to freely think, help people to be wise in the way that they give and wise in the way that they think, and to look for truth rather than for some way that supports what the family needs or whatever, or what that individual seeks to have. Interesting. Okay, let's talk about how this affects society. When we have a civilization or a society that doesn't use love in a universal way, but uses it in extremely narrow, almost silly ways of giving that are counterintuitive, counterproductive. It may be intuitive to some people, but they're wrong. And those ways become like a cancer. They grow, unfortunately, much more rapidly than does the soul aspect of giving to help others become more giving wisely. That kind of gets lost in the shuffle. And the society grows more and more based upon the superficial context of a very narrow way of personally giving to people in personal ways. Such kinds of uses and abuses of the society builds institutions of what we call shallow nature and makes almost everybody else that is in contact or interactional with those institutions more shallow. Shallow lives lead to unloving lives that also, over time, become meaningless. You could be very creative, by the way, using the beginning of the show's ideas, but if you're very unloving, the shallowness produced by that effect will still lead to a loss, a tremendous loss in meaning in life. There have been some great, great creators in our society and other societies that have done some amazing things, but they lacked what we're talking about in terms of the consciousness and love for people in general, say maybe of the wife. Those people almost always had difficult lifetimes, even though they were very creative. If you go historically and look at what I'm talking about, you'll see that there's an amazing connection or correlation between the people who are most creative but most unloving and the loss of meaning in their lives and the lack of, we'll say, a lifetime that they enjoyed and that they brought light to others. Yet they still create a lot of things, a lot of whatever. So it's a fascinating idea. Again, this is how you see the benefits of understanding ageless wisdom, because you can correct all this, can't you? If you see this happening, you can help others too, maybe up to a certain point, if they'll hear you. These are not easy concepts to understand, but they are very valuable, because there are lots of answers that can be found that are not found anyplace else. All right, so then what does the concept then of improving people's senses of spirit and form, of making things that do so for everybody else, which is beauty, in terms of love. Well, similar to the creative side, when people are loving, they want to make beauty because not just because the beauty makes them feel better, but they want everybody else to enjoy, everybody else to benefit, everybody else to gain consciousness or understanding from experiencing the beauty that each of us is creating and or preserving and or disseminating. So all this is going on at that level if we are doing, we'll say, the benefit side of Angel's Wisdom. There's a lot of people who aren't, and those people oftentimes find their life forceful, with many people in strange ways being hostile towards them, because they don't even realize that they are uglifiers. They think, well, I'm just doing what's perfunctory, I'm doing what's best for everybody, even if it's not beautiful. Well, what's best for everybody is the giving of beauty and preserving it and helping others to be able to better sense it and enjoy it. And spreading this not just to human beings, but to all forms of life. This is a big deal, and people who are into universal love follow that principle. I realize that it seems as though most people don't, but that's because it's eroded. We've been eroding it for decades here in the United States and in a lot of other countries. The erosion of this condition of universal love leads eventually to a kind of universal meaninglessness and a distraught nature to all forms of people trying to be loving towards each other. It's very difficult to express a universal love in an ugly environment that people ignore and are trying to do something about it, much less are doing something about it. So you get into that kind of problem, and that's why it's so unfortunately a more serious part of life than we might recognize on the surface. Okay, let me move on. When people are doing conceptual thought in terms of giving, giving conceptual thought is different than creating conceptual thought. Giving conceptual thought is helping other people to think in ways that they, for themselves, can find truth. Not that you tell them the truth. I know that's a difficult one. If you're telling people the truth is, bang, 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 and they don't get the concepts because you're telling them the truth, that's not loving. That is the opposite of loving. It's dictatorial. It robs people of the ability to think more in ways that are higher in structure and greater in the ability to analyze the concepts that they're thinking in, and therefore to be able to find truth. People who are loving in terms of conceptual, we'll call it, sharing of concepts with other people, and the ability to express their own idea without telling other people what they need to think or how they even should think, that gives a whole different meaning to the idea of loving in a, we'll call it, truth-creating, conceptual understanding way of thinking. When we let go of the need to tell people the truth or to convince them of what is true and to just help them to understand concepts and to put them together for themselves, then the process becomes one of shared love. The reason it's shared is that in order to do this, what I'm talking about, it's what I'm doing with you as I speak to you right now, I hope, and it's an act of love in itself, but the love goes in two different directions. The love is that others may find truth for themselves. They may find betterments of the concepts so they can give truth that's even more better in a sense back, but it isn't, they're not saying the truth, they give a better concept so the, it could be me or anyone could understand it more. And then, in addition, at the same time, those doing the explaining of a concept, doing what they can to help others to think better, become better thinkers themselves, it's a form of improving the ability they have to give better and wiser in the future. The ability to give with wisdom means that the concept is applied in the giving. And so the two are being practiced at the same time. One is helping others to understand the concept, while the concept is improving the person who is giving in some way, so that that concept now becomes even larger and more meaningful to them in various circumstances and issues. So it's always a great thing to be able to do this. It's the combining of the element of teaching within the second way, but it has to do specifically with monastic development, or helping people to find truth for themselves. And so that's the big part of it. When it's done properly, then real love is involved. If it's done with abuse and improperly, then it's the opposite of love. It's selfish, and the object is usually to control others and manipulate them. Pretty negative kind of thing, for sure. Okay, and then when we look at the idea of helping people to find love through the understanding of what God is. Well, you could do this, I guess, if you were a pastor of some sort, a religious teacher of some sort. But the problem with all of those is that, again, the universal love is missing, because you are only loved if your faith is a similar faith to the person who's trying to help you discover God. Otherwise, you're not part of that religion, so then that person says, well, you got to go someplace else to get that because you're not my religion. That's what's wrong with it. That shows a lack of love. To someone who, I don't care what faith they were, to someone who says, I don't care what faith you are. If you want to know God, I'll try to tell you as much as I can about God without it being that you have to understand all the things I understand about my religion. I'm willing to talk about God in more general terms or as best as my religion can explain it without you having to do something that's specific in the religion. And so this is a challenge when dealing with it from this focus. For most people, the benefits of angel's wisdom when doing a loving act that has a religious issue or a singular way of understanding God is to break the, we'll say, covenant of having to put it in only the perspective of the religion itself. To use the religion to move beyond it and to look at it from a more universal side, because God is greater than any religion could ever be. I'm afraid that's the truth. So when we look at it from that particular standpoint, it helps to then modify the way we give to people, no matter what religion we believe in or no matter what our ideas of God are, so that we open ourselves to giving them both our perspective of God, the perspective of faith in general in relationship to God, and what the religion that we know of says but doesn't, but not putting it on, well, you can only really listen to what I'm saying, you can only hear what I will only tell you what I'm going to say, if you at least are open to becoming my part of my religion, much less already are. That is a very, very selfish position. And most religions have some element of that in them. So there's a grand selfishness about explaining about God what it has only within the context of one's own belief structure. Open belief is that God exists, and God probably has these qualities, and God is like angel's wisdom, but then that comes from a benefit of understanding angel's wisdom and not necessarily from the religion itself. And I guess I am saying that, although I don't think it's absolutely necessary that a person knows or has ever even heard of angel's wisdom and still could help somebody to understand God from a more loving or open-minded position outside of the tenets of their own faith. Interesting point. Now, there are various religions that would vehemently disagree with my position, so be aware of that. I'm not assuming that everybody is going to even say that what I'm explaining is okay with them. I think what it is it's an explanation that's valuable and helpful, but it may be against some people's belief structure too far, and they can't accept it. Although I'm explaining the benefits of angel's wisdom tonight, not going to debate that factor. It's just that this is the benefit if you go down the angel's wisdom road is how you will get over the issues that I'm talking about. All right, so then we come to finally the synthesis of love, because that's really the last thing, the seventh ray approach. And the synthesis of love is a really fascinating idea. This is one of the most difficult things for people to understand, because most people see love as a very, very narrow kind of thing, one person to another, or if you are a communist, well, the synthesis of love is the government will tell you who or what and how love will be doled out, so to speak. When you truly synthesize love, the expectation is that love is not a one-directional way of expression between any two or 20 or 1,000 or a million or a billion people. It instead is the interaction. And this is the difficult part in angel's wisdom. When you synthesize love, when you apply the seventh ray to it, you assume that everything you give to someone, you're receiving something from at the same time. That is the synthesis of love. It also means that although you don't expect the others that you're giving to necessarily give back to you, you expect them to give in general, which in any way is giving back to everybody, including you. And you're giving to yourself in equal measure in all circumstances where you're truly loving. Why? Because in each case, you become more your soul, and you become less addicted or connected to being subconscious and controlled by a part of you that is subconscious called the personality. The personality is moving also into a position of becoming the material part or the energy part of the soul, so it's becoming something greater too. You're not denying it, you're not destroying it, you're helping it to grow. While it is losing control over the conscious part of you, which is connecting with the spirit in the soul and becoming more a thinking being on a soul level, which is really on a God level as far as we're concerned. The process is fascinating, and this is the synthesis of love. Now, when you understand the synthesis from the standpoint of understanding angel's wisdom, this whole thing makes a total change in the way that a person loves. Unfortunately, I'm going to tell you this is my experience, because I try to do this synthesis of love. It is unwelcomed and sometimes rejected by others as being some bizarre and selfish and sometimes even evil way of interacting with other people. The reason for it is that it is so radically different that most people just don't really get it. They don't understand it. And again, they're not following or trying to understand angel's wisdom. They're not trying to understand even God. And so the result is that they misunderstand and misperceive and may even reverse, oftentimes, the motives and what the benefits are that a person is trying to do in synthesizing love. And so there's almost a, we'll say, a serious backlash to doing this in some circumstances. I'm not saying don't do it. I'm just giving forewarning that don't expect that it always will come back from others as being some wonderful thing. Oh, yeah, you synthesize love. I got it. Every time you give to everybody else, you're receiving something back, and you find that that's wonderful because you're becoming more a soul while everybody else is as well. And it's a terrific thing. They just won't see it that way. How come it's so difficult to see? Well, partly because evil is here on Earth. If we were not with so much evil, or if evil was not here at all, people would see the right thing. But because evil has made a bunch of models that are reversed from it, and very convincingly so, evil is against the synthesis of love as best as it can, particularly since it threatens its own existence in the physical world if it succeeds in a very big way. So it tries to confound people and to convince them that something other than what's really happening is going on. It's easy to twist it because it's elusive. Synthesis of love requires a lot of conceptual understanding of the process and great sense. Well, a lot of people are missing parts of that. And so with evil that's abounding, it's easy for those that are evil to convince other people of the reverse. Because it doesn't look the same as what most other people are practicing. And since they're doing the more selfish thing, they don't have the consciousness to realize that what you're doing is the more magnanimous and wonderful thing. You see the problem here. And it's no easy challenge. I'm going to tell you that right now that in my life, I have found a great disappointment as over the last couple of decades, particularly, I've taught as best as I can Ageless Wisdom. And people have incredibly mistaken notions about who and what I am and what I'm doing and whatever the story may be. Because they're so convinced by the propaganda that synthesis of love is, and they don't use that word or terminology, they'll use some other words, but is really evil and dark, because after all, the real way you love is blank, 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 which is very structured and, of course, narrow and reduces the ability for others to become their souls. But it's still right there. Everybody says, well, you're going to do these 10 things. And if you're not doing those 10 things, then you aren't loving. And how come you aren't willing to give these people that or that? How come you're standing in their way? How come you may be forcibly preventing them from doing things by either doing something that they don't like or, you know, extolling some right or law against them or whatever the story might be? How dare you do that? But under the principles of synthesis of love, it's still doing the right thing and doing the most you can do to help others become souls. It may not be what they want, but don't get me wrong. In synthesis of love, some people, particularly the darker people, are going to hate what you're doing. That's not, I didn't say it's an evaluative thing based upon whether someone else that you're doing something for is able to appreciate or be grateful for it. That is not the yardstick. Remember that. It's how much are you helping others to become souls, which may be against what they want to be. Maybe they're evil already. They barely have a soul, or they don't have one. They're detached. Well, then you're trying to save them to become ensouled again by human soul, not by the soul of you, of evil. Okay, so you see, this is a complicated and a messy issue. But I do want you to realize that this is an important thing to challenge yourself to try to do, because you will find the benefit of understanding Ageless Wisdom from it huge. Becoming a soul more is the big deal. There are so many benefits that in just that one thing that it boggles the mind, and you wonder then why it's never been doing it, because the dark side has been so successful in its propaganda, and there are so many institutions it has built up besides its propaganda that really rule the day and prevent people who aren't fully understanding from doing the loving thing. Okay, so let's now talk about the last part of our journey tonight, and that is, how does a person interact with these benefits of understanding angels' wisdom so that they become more a model of service? How are they going to achieve this level that is the real promise, so to speak, of understanding angels' wisdom? Because ultimately, if you became all the things I said up to this point in the show, which is a couple hours now of talking about, you understand all that, but you don't do a thing with it. In other words, you say, well, okay, I got it all. It's wonderful. What a wonderful system. But you know what? I think I'll go fishing. Or I'll do something else. Or whatever. And you just ignore that the interactive part of God's mind is extremely important. Because if you're not willing to interact with others and actually apply these things from a moment-to-moment basis, and to see where you can actually be of service and do something about it, then amazingly, the benefits of ageless wisdom may eventually go away. Not immediately. For a while, a person can study ageless wisdom and can gain some great consciousness and improve their creativity in life. But if they don't choose to eventually direct it into spiritual service, more and more so, over time, they will eventually lose the meaning that they gave, and their life will usually crash and burn, give it enough time. And assuming they don't die or whatever is going to happen. So it's fascinating to think that we're given a lot of leeway. You can spend maybe decades, you know, not doing the spiritual service that you should be doing. Every day that goes by, though, it becomes more difficult. That becomes the obstacle that you have to fight against the next day. So it isn't like there's not a great penalty to pay by doing nothing. There is. It just becomes more difficult to do the same as you could have done the day following, and the month, and the year, etc. Interactually, spiritual service means that you're helping to change you're helping to change and reduce the forces that are inherent in the physical world and even in the astral and mental, but much, much, much less as you move into those other dimensions. And you're able to take these forces and reduce them. The reduction comes from the willingness to involve yourself in the forces and to recognize that sometimes these forces will cause harm, sometimes they will be difficult to deal with, sometimes they may even significantly reduce some meaning in a person's life that's trying to deal with them. But in the long run, the real change is to change the physical world we're in, especially here, because that's why we came here, be more godly, to be more virtuous. That means spirit in form, which reduces the forces. And so if we're willing to do that, and if we're really, you know, at a point where we might say, well, okay, I'm willing to do anything it takes because that's what spiritual life is about, then you have found the true benefits of understanding angels' wisdom, because once that's done, that becomes a permanent change in both the world and in your higher self, and you become more and more soul-like at a very fast pace in comparison to the, we'll call it, relatively slow pace that takes place during the first two parts of God's mind, which is being spiritual, but not applying it to a interactive way with others, and which we call spiritual service. So without the service part, there's a definite, almost chopped-off part of existence where meaning ceases to further develop, and the meaning that you may have developed starts to erode. You can only go so far, in understanding ageless wisdom if you're not willing to serve spiritually. For a lot of people, I say it's like a year or two if they're really immersed in it, or it may be a decade or more if they're not. But after that, meaning starts to erode significantly without a lack, with a lack of spiritual service. And most people, although they may be willing to understand more about ageless wisdom, are not willing to serve. I mean the majority. It's over half. That is a big problem. And it's the nature of today's world that is the challenge, because the forces are not getting less, but they're getting more. So when you ignore spiritual service, the forces build more rapidly in everybody's life, and it becomes more and more difficult, as in a strictly inertial problem, to overcome that, so the life can easily become more and more meaningless and even lost. Lost from the sense that the soul sees no value in a person living a life that way. Oh, yeah, you gained a lot of understanding about ageless wisdom, but you weren't willing to apply it in spiritual service. And over time, that becomes a real problem. It doesn't become a problem just because you did it for the first few months of understanding more about ageless wisdom. But a few years, it might. So there's a danger to this, because the thing can really backfire. A person can gain understanding, let's say they listen to me on the radio, I think, I know. Or they can be reading something that I or others have written, thinking about it, trying to understand it better, maybe going to a class, yet they don't do anything in spiritual service. The danger is that over time, they may suffer greater consequences than if they had done nothing. It's still a good thing from the standpoint that even if they fail in this life, they're more likely to succeed in the astral world and mental world and in their next physical lifetime. So that's the good news. The bad news is they may suffer because of loss of consciousness. After they should be serving, they really aren't, and there's more and more reasons to be spiritually serving, and they aren't. And then it can be a kind of accelerated karma that causes a lot of disruption and negative things to happen. And then they wonder, well, I studied ageless wisdom. Why I have greater understanding, more consciousness, at least I had more. But why is this all happening? Because their consciousness didn't grow enough because they refused to apply it in spiritual service. And eventually that became the Achilles heel that caused the whole thing to fall apart. It takes time. It won't happen immediately in most circumstances. So you don't have to like worry, oh, gee, if I do this for a week, I'm going to be in big trouble. But if you do it long enough, and if you do it enough, period, and you still refuse to spiritually serve, the results are going to be harsh. More forces than you would have had, with more difficulties than you would have had. Now, I'm not saying this to scare people. I'm saying this to encourage them to spiritually serve. Because spiritual service resolves this whole thing. Now, what does it mean to spiritually serve? I mean, is that, you know, you write a letter to me, maybe, and I'll tell you what to do? No. What it means is that you are faced with numerous, too many to speak of, opportunities to help others to become souls. And each one challenges you to go beyond your comfort zone, to be more creative, to be more loving, and to interact in ways and places and things that you normally wouldn't do, again, mostly for fear, and in some cases for effort, and in some cases for negative consequences of some sort that seem negative, like loss of money or time or energy. And so all these things happen, and you wonder, well, what am I going to do then? Well, the answer is that you can solve the problem by becoming more spiritual. If you become more spiritual faster, you overcome the acceleration in karma because you changed the negative things that were going to happen into opportunities to be of service to others. That's exactly what happens. And so all of a sudden, you had all these problems, and now you have all these ways of being of service to others. That is just a wonderful way of being creative. Things that you thought were problems were problems in yourself, usually fears, and were brought about by a reluctance to serve. Now you could say, well, what happens when evil is after you? If you're doing a great job serving, isn't that a problem? Not really. If you serve more, you will eventually overcome the evil. And getting rid of evil, or getting rid of some parts of evil, is a very big deal. So you're doing service. The service is that. And there's no such thing as being destroyed by the forces of evil, because those forces almost always make us more into higher beings, and so we don't worry about that. The form may be destroyed, it's possible. I mean, evil may set off a bomb or something and destroy a lot of people, and you may be one of them. Although in most circumstances, if you're really doing the true spiritual service I'm talking about, the soul arranges for you to stay around, no matter what the evil one's doing. They try and try, but they never manage to succeed. That's kind of fascinating in itself. And it has a whole other bent that I can't go into tonight, because that deals with all kinds of things about the energy kingdom and interactions of spirit and form. And there's a lot of things that you get into when you start talking about those kinds of miraculous events, so to speak, going on. All right. Spiritual service then becomes the solution to the problem of not spiritually serving. Okay? But what about the people who still say, I'm not going to spiritually serve because I'll lose money, I'll lose time, it's a lot of effort, and what if it doesn't work anyway, and what about the people who just take and don't give? So forget about me. If you are into that way, the best thing that can be done is to get into what's called the contemplation, and the, we'll call it meditation, of service, so that you can convince yourself that the spiritual service that you're contemplating will eventually resolve the problem that you're having about forces and the fears that you have about them. You just have to take things a lot further. You can talk to people maybe like me, and some of those people may have some suggestions how to do this very thing. Remember, you don't get the spiritual service, though, till you have gained better understanding about how to be free and creative and to do and have done so to some extent at the minimum, and how you become more universally loving and more conscious. Those are predecessors to the spiritual service. Because otherwise, your spiritual service will have so many mistakes in it, so many misapplied efforts, that the likelihood of success are very small, and the likelihood of causing more harm than good is high. I'm not just talking about harm to yourself. I'm talking about harm to everybody and everything else around you. So it's important to look at this as a progressive kind of thing, going from one point to another. You're trying to move the process of spiritual development, but not jump into trying to do it at the end, because if you're doing that, you're spiritually ambitious rather than spiritually disciplined, and your results are probably going to be very bad. They're not going to work out for you at all, and maybe not for anybody you think that you're trying to spiritually serve. This takes a prudent mind, one that understands much of what I'm saying, even from the inside out, more than the outside in, which is like the outside in. So you've done it, and you can see it, and you understand it from that standpoint, rather than just listening to me talk about it, or having written about it, or whatever. And so now you have the opportunity to apply it in a more wise way. One where the outcome is not guaranteed, but it is more likely than not that you will succeed in your approach. This is a good way to be. And for a lot of people, this is one of the, we'll say, quagmires that they fall into. They have trouble deciding what they should be doing at a particular time, and they think, well, I'll just do this or that because that's spiritual service. And of course, oftentimes ends up being a waste of the resources and those of others. The reason is they didn't balance it. They don't have that triad of balance that they need. they didn't become creative enough before, or they didn't become universally loving enough, or conscious, the same word to me, before. Those two things together would have required a more spiritual overall person before they became spiritually in service. So those who try serving before they've done the other two are spiritually ambitious and falsely trying to serve. Their service is usually neglectful, it is misplaced, it produces bad results, and is destructive to themselves and others. It causes a lot of suffering in themselves and sometimes to others. And so it has no value. And some people, you know, say, well, I did for 3 years this, and I was calling it spiritual service, and look at the bad outcome. So I did my stint, and I'm not going to do any more because that's it, right? It didn't work out. To them, it may prove that what I'm saying is wrong, and it may not even be a God because look at all the spiritual service they did, it didn't work out. Well, God says that you must be the creator and you must be the lover or conscious being first. Then you can go and do God's bidding, which is spiritually served, so to speak, which is still not God's bidding because it's your bidding. It's to become your soul right here, right now. The soul created us. Each of us was created by our soul to do that very thing while we were physically incarnate. It has a plan, and that plan is part of the process. But we've got to take the initiative to become interactive in it and not sit at the sidelines and pretend like, well, I did my share, I read this book, I went and talked to people, we all commiserated, we did a full moon meditation, we held hands and sang Kumbaya. And that should be enough, right? And if that's what you think is spiritual service, then you've got the wrong idea, in my opinion. You could get to the point of spiritual serving by doing a little bit of that to recognize that that isn't spiritual service, because sometimes that seeing what isn't spiritual service helps us to be better on focus, helps us to be pointed in the direction that we need to be. When we do this interaction with others, that will really help them to become more souls while we become one ourselves. Remember, it goes just like the love does both ways. When you spiritually serve, you're not helping just other people being souls, you're helping yourself become a soul through the interactions. But remember, on an interactional basis, you're also changing the physical world. Love changes the astral world, but not the physical. So every kind of spiritual service here on physical earth causes a change in the physical world itself, eventually. It may not do it in an immediate sense, but it will always, if it is spiritual service, result in a significant, over time, change in the physical world to become more virtuous. There'll be more light in form in the physical form of the physical world if what you're doing is true spiritual service here. And you can see that light. You can understand it. Others can as well. And it's you can evaluate it. So the good news is that spiritual service is always tangible in some way. I like that because if it wasn't, with all the other illusions that we have, a lot of people would never really get it. But the good news is it's actually right there in front of you. And the bad news is that even though it's in front of some people, they're so in illusion because they didn't prepare through the other things I've said, you know, the first two parts of this, that they still don't get it. Those people, yeah, they may lose that lifetime. It's true in the physical sense. It happens more often than not these days because Earth is in a very bad way, and there's a lot of people in significant illusion who incarnate all the time. And we're just not getting to where I would like it to be. But it's slowly moving, somewhat. Maybe not fast enough, and that's what's dangerous. Okay, then if it's right in your face, and you really should notice it, even if some people don't, what do you do when you do? let's assume that you're doing spiritual service, and it's right in your face that some of the things you're doing are failing to make a change in the world around, physical world, and you are looking, therefore, for a change in that, because you know from what I've just explained, but you can also figure it out for yourselves, because you shouldn't just listen to me, you should think about it and see if I'm really right. Then the steps that need to be taken when you face that kind of problem means that you can visibly, tangibly understand, see, touch, feel, whatever, that there is a lack of light, virtue, in the forms around you, produced by your supposed spiritual service. It means you're making some huge mistake in what you perceive of what should be spiritual service. And sometimes it's the application itself, sometimes it's the idea of what the service is supposed to be, sometimes it's the choice of those you're choosing to serve, that's a big one, sometimes it's others behind the scenes deliberately trying to sabotage you. Yes, you actually have those things, terrible as they may be, happen. And sometimes it's because of unusual karmic circumstances, maybe coming from your own past life, or the one part of this life, or sometimes it's from a conglomerate of past lives of people you know or don't know, that is pushing in the other direction, in the direction of what you consider to be your spiritual service. Any of those things, the best way to overcome it is the following. Recognize it's the elements of your spiritual service that are off. They are off because there are forces against it that are greater than the ability that you have to do the service that you think is needed. Change your spiritual service direction. It doesn't have to go completely off into some new direction, but it needs some modification so that it does create virtue. It does make enlighten. And if it's not doing that, then you need to make it do it that way, and you got to use your consciousness and your creative purpose so that you can achieve, a new kind of interaction that produces the kind of, we'll call it, improvement in the world, virtue, that you tangibly and others tangibly can perceive. You can ask others for assistance, because your perception of what is virtuous may not be correct. So get the values from others and see what they think. If others can tell you what virtue is there and you can't see it immediately, assume they're right and you're wrong, and work on trying to figure out what it is you're missing about this. Be aware that getting information from others about spiritual service is probably more important than sitting in a corner trying to figure it out for yourself. Part of the problem of the failure in spiritual service is illusion. It's the inability to adequately see what light or not light is coming from our chosen interactions with everything around us. A lot of people make that mistake. Part of the mistake, again, can come from karmic issues and can come from all the things I said, but still there's an illusion there, too. Illusion is so strong in this world that almost everything is tainted by it. No matter what your intentions are, spiritual service may be fouled up by illusion because your senses just don't give you the information you need in an accurate way, and or the personality is not applying that information in a way that comes out with whole knowledge. Or finally, you may even have some whole knowledge, but then you take that knowledge and you create concepts that are the antithesis of eventually what is correct or true. Working from the wrong side of the truth can lead us into all kinds of weird and mistaken interactions. That's, again, helped by getting others' opinions. Use those people who you see making the most wise choices, especially those who are spiritually serving. There is no better yardstick than someone you're convinced of, and you're convinced not because of your own perceptions, but because many other people are perceiving it, that that person or those people are spiritually serving. Use them as the yardstick, because the greatest way of being aware of and understanding those that are truly spiritually serving is in the ability to see what they are actually doing and recognize it for what it is, and then using them as a yardstick against what one is doing themselves, who might not be doing very much, and seeing the difference and saying, there it is. That's why spiritual groups are very helpful, whether you're a member of one or just can watch one functioning, because it gives you that yardstick. It lets you better balance and understand whether or not the spiritual service you think you're doing is the spiritual service that really needs to be done, and whether you're doing it in a way that is creating virtue in the world, or are you doing it in a way that's making things worse, maybe for yourself and or others. These are the things that really get to the crux of the issue. Again, spiritual groups help us immensely, particularly in a complicated world of forces. When the world had forces, but it was more simplistic, like it was this force or that, you could pick one or the other, but you didn't have a million to pick from, well, then you didn't need spiritual groups so much, because you could figure it out for yourself. In this world, there are so many different forces pushing in so many different ways, and so much interactions from the forces themselves and between us and others who are trying to serve. I mean, it becomes almost impossible without the help of others to really get to the foundation of it. Our illusions being different allows each of us to serve someone else. We may both be illusion to the same level, but they're different illusions. And if that's the case, we can gain something from the others who are not as illusioned in some ways, but just equally or more illusioned in others. And that's the good way of working together. I'm not suggesting that people work together become automatons of others, or to only do the things that others are doing or in ways that they're doing. Rather, to use those people as a yardstick to challenge whether or not those things that don't seem to be going right can be better changed in adopting some of the ideas that these other folks have. That's what's so wonderful about interaction today. And it's only getting better, not worse, in that respect. You should be aware of that. Everybody says, everything's getting worse. Well, not exactly. Not exactly. The world's getting tougher to live in. But if we were to work together as spiritual people among spiritual groups, and each group help each other group, it could really add a tremendous amount of benefit to the system. If is a big word. And has that happened yet? Not much. As a matter of fact, some spiritual groups are the most separative of all other kinds of things, and that's a real negative. Today, that's a big poison pill for us, and we're going to need to overcome that in very short order. Because that's the big hope, that we're going to be able to go the right direction with this. Well, I'm running out of time, and it's too bad, because there's a lot more to say even about this particular side of it. I hope this has kind of given everybody an idea of why understanding ageless wisdom has so many benefits, because it answers all of the quagmires and questions that most people have, in my opinion. And I believe it does. All of them. All the questions can be answered. But if it only answered half of them, it's a benefit. If it only answered maybe 10% of them, it's a benefit. So please be aware that there's a tremendous value to understanding ageless wisdom. And I know there was a lot more I didn't cover in tonight's show, but I think I did enough to maybe make the point. And for next week, we'll be back down to about a two-hour show. Remember that. So it will be a little bit different, but again, they'll be just as hopefully insightful as they have been, if you think they are. And until next week, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.